Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Joe Heschmeyer still here with us. We haven't worn him out yet, so we got another hour of open forum. If you don't know Joe, well, you should know Joe. He's got a lot of great books. The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, the most recent published book. He's got a new book on the Eucharist that's going to be out in July. He wrote a wonderful book on St. Joseph called A Man Named Joseph. I Man Named Joseph.
I was just giving a clue.
You're helping me in the background. You're like a mom helping a preschooler. A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times. He also wrote Pope Peter, the subtitle of which is
Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I was just testing you, Joe. Yeah. I was testing you on that
one. It was a test. I was literally blanked for a second.
You're getting enough books in your in your collection now that you sometimes got to struggle for the full title.
Yeah, it's true. Or I'm just getting old. One of those. I prefer your
explanation. They happen at the same time, Joe. What's the Eucharist book out?
The Eucharist is really Jesus, and I think it's coming out in July, so I'm very excited.
Wonderful.
I've got a copy of it myself, and I like it.
You're happy with it? Oh, you got the galleys?
I'm pleased with it. It'll be one of those things. It's kind of that nerve-wracking moment where you've got a thing that you love that you shared with the world, and it's not yet shared with the world. And so you're like, I hope everybody really likes this, but maybe they'll hate it. And either way, it's good for me.
God has a plan in all of this, but we need books about the Eucharist. I mean, that you're really participating in a wider movement of the Church, which is it's almost like to re-educate the Church to her own, the greatest gift that God gave her.
A re-amazement.
Yeah, a re-amazement. I had never heard it put that way. Nicely done.
I'm stealing that, yeah. The From Eucharistic who? Amazement is what they're calling the kind of the nationwide movement. So a re-amazement is, I guess, my spin on that, that there's a need to return to being wowed by the gift that we have. I don't know if I've shared this before. I was talking with a Pentecostal young woman when I was in college, and she said, as a Pentecostal, she was a big believer in miracles, and that she thought Catholics were sort of oblivious to how big their belief in miracles was. She's like, look, you believe every day at Mass there's a miracle. How do you not think that's a bigger deal than it is? And it was like, that's a good point. you can know, like, the body and blood of Christ are now where bread and wine used to be.
Right.
And it's like, it's a big deal.
A very big deal, right. And, I think that many people get it more than the polls show and all that kind of thing, but we're inconsistent. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think it is a mystery, and people respond to mysteries mysteriously in a way. And so it's not always easy to quantify. I do find the numbers disturbing, but I think...
Let me speak to that, if I may.
Yeah, please.
The Gallup poll that showed only like a third of Catholics believed in the real presence.
Yeah.
If you break that down, among those who didn't go to Mass, like virtually nobody knew what the Church taught about the Eucharist. If you looked at people who were regular Mass goers, the rates were high.
Yeah.
And so in that sense... It shows there's a good connection between good Eucharistic theology and actually bothering to go to Mass. And I think the road goes in both directions. If you go to Mass, you're more likely to hear about the Eucharist. But also, if you believe in the Eucharist, you're more likely to go to Mass.
And that's just certainly true. I mean, if you believe in the Eucharist, there's this huge thing. Jesus is waiting for me in the Church. Like, it's hard to just kind of zero that out. Let's take some calls, Joe.
Yeah, let's. All right. Oh, by the way, before we do, Joe in Toledo, I really liked your call, and we didn't have time in the first hour. If you get a chance, please give us a call back.
All right, come on, Joe. Joe in Toledo, call back. Virginia in Louisiana, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Virginia, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question really kind of dovetails with your discussion on the Eucharist. Briefly, I am a new convert to Catholicism.
Welcome home.
Having been raised and attended regularly the Episcopal Church, a high Episcopal Church, where it was taught to me all the time that... the bread and wine become the blood and body of Jesus, reverse that, you know, the body image.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I, you know, and I'm one of those people who, you know, every week was just amazed and just, you know, just filled with the Lord and filled and on fire for God after taking the Eucharist. And so now I am Catholic, and also that's continuing. And my question has to do with, if that is what my attitude was and thought process was growing up and in my adulthood, when I go to church with my family, when I go to the Episcopal Church with them, I have a hard time, because to me it is Jesus in that bread and wine. You know, I need Jesus. I have a hard time not taking communion and feeling that somehow in doing so I would be sinning. And I'd like your response on that.
Okay, so there's two questions there. One is on the validity of Anglican sacraments in terms of the Eucharist. And the other is, if there is a valid Eucharist, but we don't have full communion, what's appropriate then? Because regardless of what the answer is on Anglicans, you've got church bodies like the Eastern Orthodox, Oriental Orthodox, where they have the real presence. And then it's like, okay, so what should our posture be? So to the first question, the 39 articles of religion, the kind of closest thing you have to like an Anglican creed, I think it's maybe fair to say, teach pretty explicitly against transubstantiation. So in Article 28, it says transubstantiation, or the change of the substance of bread and wine in the supper of the Lord, cannot be proved by Holy Writ, but is repugnant to the plain words of Scriptures, overthrows the nature of a sacrament, and has given occasion to many superstitions. The body of Christ is given, taken, and eaten in the supper only after a heavenly and spiritual manner. And the mean whereby the body of Christ is received and eaten in the supper is faith. So they condemn as superstition transubstantiation. Now, I should point out, the earlier articles of faith of the Anglican Communion explicitly endorse transubstantiation. So you have a problem within Anglicanism, where at one time it proclaims as an article of faith a thing that it then turns around and says is false and superstitious and heretical. Those can't both be true, obviously. And so...
Right.
The problem is Anglo-Catholics are trying to kind of have it both ways, of trying to preserve that the bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ, even though their own church says that's false and superstitious and bad and wrong. And so that's the problem on one end. The problem on the other end is that in order to have the actual consecration, in order to turn the bread and wine into the body and blood of Jesus Christ, it's not enough that I believe in the real presence. Like, if you gave me unleavened bread and you gave me wine and said, hey, can you celebrate Mass for me? I would say, no, I can't. And it doesn't, you could leave me in a room for 50 years and I wouldn't be able to celebrate Mass because I don't have orders. I don't have the laying on of hands that conforms me to Christ's head in that way. And one of the other things, as the Anglicans decisively break with transubstantiation and decisively break with a Catholic understanding of the Eucharist and of the Mass, they also change the rite of ordination to make it clear that they're not ordaining what are called sacerdotal ministers. They're not ordaining priests who can actually offer sacrifice, because they deny that this is a sacrifice. And so they do a really good job of that. They do a really good job of ending holy orders. They end apostolic succession. When they originally go into schism, they still had it. During the reign of Henry VIII, even the bishops and priests who had gone into schism from the church by following Henry rather than the Pope, they were still able to consecrate the Eucharist. They were still able to have Mass. But under Edward, they changed the rites to abolish the Catholic priesthood and to abolish this kind of priesthood. So now you've got a group of well-meaning Anglicans who want the real presence. They want transubstantiation, but they don't have real priests, and so they can't have it. And so, to clarify this, Leo XIII explicitly says Anglican orders are absolutely null and utterly void. Like, there's no question these are Protestant ministers parading around as Catholic priests. They're not. And so they can't consecrate the Eucharist any more than you or I could. So that's a problem on a sacramental level. That's the first half of the question. So the Anglicans, even if they believe in the real presence, they don't have it. The second, which is not, by the way, which is not to say that Christ can't be present in some way. He's just not present in that way. He's not present sacramentally in the Eucharistic way he is in the Mass. The second question is about communion, that even if they had communion, when you receive the Eucharist, this is a twofold communion. It's a communion with Jesus Christ, and it's also a communion with his church. And so Anglicans made a very deliberate decision during the time of Henry and then repeatedly after to break away from the communion of the church. They didn't want to be in communion with the Pope. They didn't want to be in communion with the broader church. They wanted to do their own national thing. And so inasmuch as Eucharist is communion with the church, it's a bit contradictory to say you're in communion with a heretical schismatic sect and you're in communion with the broader church, because the two bodies say we don't believe the same thing. We're not in communion with one another right now. I would love to see all Anglicans be in full communion with the Catholic Church. I love the Anglican Ordinariate, in which there are former Anglicans who are now preserving Anglican patrimony in full union with the church. So we welcome that. We embrace that. Our chaplain here at Catholic Answers, until very recently, was, you know, he is a former Anglican who is able to preserve that heritage in the fullness of the faith in union with the Pope. But to go into a communion that doesn't have that communion with the church and then to want to receive communion is like pledging allegiance to two sides in a civil war. Maybe that's not a great analogy, but hopefully you get the idea. But you, just like you can't be a faithful Confederate and a faithful American, you can't be in communion with the Anglicans and the Catholics.
So if I do, or if I have taken communion in an Episcopal church, is that a sin? Do I have to confess?
Yeah, I would, because you're making an act that suggests you're out of union with the Catholic Church. Someone observing that, the person behind you, is going to say, oh, okay, she became Catholic, but I guess she's not anymore because here she is receiving communion in an Anglican church. Okay. It's a case like this, if you don't know better, it's a pretty minor thing, but it's not a minor thing of itself. It's worth knowing not to do it, and it's worth not doing it to protect the fact that you believe in a different kind of union, that we're actually called as Christians into a deeper union. So I hope no one hears that as like triumphalism or needless exclusion. I want all Anglicans and all Protestants to be in full union with the Catholic Church so we can have a common Eucharist and a common celebration of the Mass. But because we're not there yet, it would be inappropriate to pretend like we are.
And okay. Virginia, thanks very much for starting us off this hour. I'll tell you what, I'd love to send you a copy of Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. I think you'll enjoy it, because that was a very enjoyable conversation for us. If you hang on the line, we'll send it to you. But I got to take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, this is Dave Vashers, president of Annunciation Radio. The scripture says when the word of God goes out, it doesn't return void, but accomplishes that for which it was sent. We regularly hear from individuals whose lives have been dramatically changed as a result of listening to Catholic radio. Tell a family member, tell a friend, tell the whole world. Change your station, and it'll change your life.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Hey, everything over at shop.catholic.com is on sale, $2, $4, $6, or $8. Unbeatable deals. Hundreds of books, ebooks, MP3s, CDs, DVDs. Also, all this weekend, while that sale is going on, double rewards points on every purchase you make. Check it all out over at shop.catholic.com. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. He's going to be giving a talk here in San Diego tonight. That's why you're here, right?
Yeah, it is. Well, actually, it's not why. I'm here because I'm giving a parish mission in St. Margaret's in Oceanside.
Oh, you are? That's my Saturday town, St. Margaret's in Oceanside.
Yeah, well, if you went to church, you would know I'm going to be there.
No one's ever asked me to speak at St. Margaret's in Oceanside. It's like five miles from my house.
You know what? They call an expert someone you bring in from outside.
Well, it's not actually my parish, though. St. Mary's, Star of the Sea downtown.
Oh, I love that parish. Church.
Oh, you know the little white church?
We've been there. My daughter's name is Stella Maris, so been there. And I have a potentially scandalous story. Yeah, my daughter's three and had been listening to a lot of Irish music. She loves the Sinead O'Connor cover of Foggy Dew because it's very dramatic and she loves drama. And she would ask me what the story's about. I'd be like, oh, it's the Irish, they're battling the English. And, you know, she'd want to know who the bad guys were and all this. Anyway, we're at St. Mary's. It's the English at the back.
Oh, okay. I didn't know which side you came down on.
Fair enough. Well, anyway, I'm not trying to fill her head with like Irish Republican propaganda. I'm not just like trying to answer questions about.
But you're
song.
Not trying to keep it out of her head either, are you, Joe?
She's asking some good questions. Is all I'm saying. So anyway, we're at Mass, and afterwards we're playing in the courtyard there. This beautiful statue of Saint Michael beating the devil, and I point to Setchin and say, who's that? And she says, St. Michael. And I say, point to the devil. I'm like, who's that? And she goes, the English? So then I thought, okay, we need to dial this back because I don't want her our English friends and thinking that they're, you know, in league with Satan. So maybe
no, she didn't say in league with Satan.
Yeah, fair enough.
She thought they were Satan.
Yeah.
So. Oh, man. And, you know, we have quite a few listeners in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, we might not anymore. That's why I said it's potentially a scandalous story. I was not trying to teach her that. She just... She internalized what she was
what listening. Kind of a household, though, do children just pick up anti-British
She loves Irish music, and some of the Irish music will recount.
You know Jesus loves everyone, right? Yes, you're aware of this?
I do. As you know, David Bates, he's married to a former Catholic Answers person.
Yeah, but
a good friend of ours is English. They can be saved.
Good old David Bates. The podcast, David Bates podcast. Pints with Jack. Yeah.
Right. Fantastic podcast.
It's all about, you know who Jack is.
Yes, C.S. Lewis.
Yes, C.S. Lewis. All right.
Why are you looking at me like, Jack?
Oh, I didn't realize. Is that why you were laughing at me? Or just because I'm so dumb today, I can't remember anything.
Darren's in the booth laughing.
Did I mention that I was
8
hours
face, so.
In an airport yesterday? Did I mention that? I'm tired. All right, let's go to Tracy in South Dakota watching on YouTube. Tracy, thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi there. So I'm very interested in learning more about Catholicism because of some friends of mine. And the thing I was going to ask is in regards to buying products from companies about, you know, that have made immoral decisions. So I've heard about the whole discussion about idol meat. Like meat sacrificed to idols. I found in 1 Corinthians there's a verse saying that you cannot dine at the table of demons and at the table of Jesus. The thing is, I own a few clothes. One of the pairs of shoes that I have, and because of this, I haven't been able to, I just haven't been wearing them. I don't know if I'm being scrupulous or not. But the company, in a news article, they released a line of shoes that featured a pentagram on it, so I haven't been able to wear it. And I know there's also shirts I own and jackets that belong to companies that have been accused of racism or that have had labor rights disputes in the Honduras, you know. And I'm just wondering because I've just been some clothes I get from thrift shops, but the pair of shoes was given to me. I wear them for my gym shoes usually. Wore them for my suit, and I like them. But it's just that's the thing. Is there a line where it's okay? You can have this if your conscience. And again, like I'm very scrupulous, so I've been searching all these companies of every so many of the clothes I own. It's like okay, are there controversies with this one? So I've been wearing, you know, and yeah, it's just been jumping around. And my question is there a line where it's okay? You don't even wear that, or is it more? Am I just what do you guys think?
You don't even have to ask what we think. The Catholic Church has a very well-developed teaching on this very topic. So Joe can give you a quite precise answer here. Go ahead, Joe. I've set you up.
Yeah.
Can you wear the...
Are you talking about formal and material cooperation with evil?
Yeah.
So this is a very good question. Because throughout, like, as I think maybe you're, even the way you prompted the question sets up, to cooperate in economic life, like if you go to a store or if you... go to a restaurant, and it's certainly if it's any kind of major chain, there's a really good chance that if you were to take a look at the company's positions on things or their behaviors and all of that, there's going to be some unscrupulous and unsavory aspects to it. And so we are forbidden not only from sin, but from applauding and encouraging and cooperating with sin. So Romans 1, verse 32 says, though they know God's decree that those who do such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but approve those who practice them. So notice that. There's two sins. One, flaunting the things that you know God has condemned. And two, applauding others flaunting the things that you know God has condemned. So if you say, oh, I haven't personally had an abortion, but I advocate for abortion, okay, well, that's also sinful. That's an easy one. The harder questions are where it's less direct. So you can't have formal cooperation. That's where you're directly involved in the evil. You're, you know, plotting it, you're doing it. Anything like that is obviously forbidden. But then you have these cases that are called material cooperation with evil. Material cooperation with evil would be, for instance, going to a Planned Parenthood, not for an abortion, but for some other checkup or something like this, where you're still cooperating with someone who does something evil, but you're not doing the evil thing directly, and you're not approving of the evil thing. In fact, you might be very firmly, very publicly against the evil thing. You know, you might say, I don't believe in anything Starbucks supports, but I still want to get a coffee. I've done this, right? Like, this is one of those questions where it becomes, okay, how close is too close a connection? And that's the question you deal with cooperation with evil. In the case of the shoe company, if this is a company that is known to have pentagrams on their shoes and has their label on the shoes, I think having the label would be the line where it's too close of cooperation. In other words, if these were unlabeled shoes and it would just, they happen to be made by the same company, that'd probably be fine. It's not very close. But if you're advertising whatever brand shoe this is, and you know that brand is in the news for making pentagram shoes, that creates a certain connotation of a connection with this company. That line can be very difficult to know where it is. Because if you go to one extreme, you could be, you know, look at it this way. If you are an employer, think about that. Instead of an employee or a customer, if you run a business and you pay your employees, they may use that money for really bad, evil stuff. You're not responsible for how they use it. On the other hand, if you say, here's $20, go buy some drugs, well, you are responsible. Now you've cooperated too directly. So do you see how there's an important line there, but the line isn't always incredibly easy to observe? So the issue here, what you're describing, is called material cooperation. And with material cooperation, the moral question is, how close am I to the evil? And you have to just discern that prudently.
Oh, hang on. I'm sorry, I put you on hold for a quick second there. How's that, what Joe had to say?
Sorry, you're back there, Tracy.
Oh yeah, no. I'm thankful that you guys gave me your input. As for the, yeah, I mean, I know that no people are perfect, and I can tell that there's times where when there's a company in the news, because it's been the first time one of the companies has been accused of racism. I think it was, might have just been a mistake that they've made twice, you know. And then there's actual shoes where it's, okay, they know what they're doing. The company's advertising a pentagram on their shoe. And right. Yeah, like I said, I tend to be a little scrupulous, wondering, like, okay, so should I throw them out? Because recently I haven't been touching my shoes recently at all, because it's like, yeah, but they kind of, yeah, a pentagram is a little, yeah, that's a bit much.
Yeah, I think something like that where it's really deliberate. This is one of those areas where it may be worthwhile to just say, I'm going to take a principled stand here and not wear any of the clothes this company has. But to give another example, I went to Target yesterday to get something last minute for my trip, and they had this huge pride section with some, you know, ridiculous messages on these clothes and everything. They're advertising things that I think are, in many cases, morally evil. Like, they're pretty actively and openly endorsing these things. I wouldn't go around wearing a Target brand t-shirt, but if I need to buy something else, I'm going to go somewhere. If I go to Walmart, they've got a bunch of moral issues. If I go, you name it, if I go to Amazon, like if I'm going to get whatever I need for my trip, there's a good chance I'm going to be dealing with some unsavory actors. If you can deal with them without seeming to endorse them or without giving anything too direct in terms of aid or support, then that's okay. And more than okay, basically unavoidable. I believe Trent is the one who I heard this example from.
The train one?
Yeah. Like if you ride on a train in Georgia, well, the train tracks were laid by slaves. You're cooperating with slavery if you participate in most institutions in modern life, not because it's currently going on, but because it was. But more than that, like modern day sweatshops and everything, you know, if you were to say, I'm not going to do any business with anyone who's unsavory, I think you will starve very quickly. Yeah. And so that's where you have to kind of draw a line. And I think especially if you know you're scrupulous, then I would just set for myself, it has to be particularly brazen. Like if you wear this and someone says, oh, you're wearing the Pentagram Company shoes, don't wear them. But if it's like, oh, well, some mid-level executive had some social faux pas that blew up, then don't worry about that.
Tracy, I think you started by saying you were interested in the Catholic faith. If you'd like a book about Catholicism, we'd love to send you Why We're Catholic if you'd like it. Our music is playing, though, which means we have to go to the break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Are you ready to defend your faith in a world of unbelief? Join us at the 9th Annual Catholic Answers Apologetics Conference. This year's theme, I Believe in God, and it'll help you provide clear and charitable answers to atheism, agnosticism, and plain old indifference. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us in San Diego from September 21st through 24th as we welcome our special guest, Dr. Scott Hahn, and an all-star lineup of great Catholic speakers. Spend quality time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and enjoy 4 days of fun, fellowship, and adoration of the Almighty. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register. Enter promo code EARLY and save $50. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. So I just want to clarify something, Joe. When you were talking with Tracy, who we just spoke with, some companies have a reputation, you know, like, for example, you did mention Amazon. Okay, so Amazon goes out of its way to say we're going to pay for abortion. Basically, for our employees, if they want an abortion, we'll pay. They're not going out of their way to say we're going to pay for babies, but right. unless they're not alive. What's my obligation there? First of all, like I do feel like in this complex environment, sometimes people have said to me like, "Oh, you use their product, whatever it is. You know, I'm drinking something." I don't know anything about this company. Right. I literally only know what they charged me for the product, and it was attractive enough that I bought it. And I don't know the story that you know. But I do know about Amazon, for example, and I don't like it.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is a good question. You are not morally required to avoid doing ordinary business with bad companies. You're just
not. Right.
And if that were true in the first century, then the Jews wouldn't be able to do business with the Romans who supported paganism, right? Like St. Paul talks about being able to go to a market in Corinth and buy meat that's been offered to idols.
Yeah.
And he says, you're not morally responsible for that. And so but you'll notice there's an important difference there. In Jerusalem, you're not allowed to eat food sacrificed to idols in Acts 15. Because in Jerusalem, it was easy to get food that wasn't. In Corinth, it was not easy to eat.
So, because that was the butcher industry, basically.
Yeah. And so you have a pagan town where all of the food may have been connected with idolatry in some way. And you wouldn't be able to necessarily know. Like, you don't have to go to that level of depth. And so I would argue that today we're more in a situation of Corinth than Jerusalem. if you were talking about an era in which like almost every company is like an upstanding company that reflects Christian values, and then you have like one bad one, it's easy to say, okay, obviously don't go to the bad one.
That's a very good point.
But it's like we have Chick-fil-A and that's it. I mean, everyone who isn't Chick-fil-A is, and even Chick-fil-A uses styrofoam. Well, so you can find nits to pick, right?
Is styrofoam bad? See, I don't even know that.
It's bad for the earth.
Is it? Styrofoam's bad for
the
earth? I think. Oh, man.
You can't recycle it, right?
I don't know what you do with styrofoam.
I don't know.
Joe, why are you asking me what you do with styrofoam? I am not.
Okay. You live in California. I just assumed this was part of your like citizen exam.
Yeah, but isn't In-N-Out Burger also kind of like the...
Oh, yeah. In-N-Out has Bible verses on it.
Yeah. On their cups.
Yeah. In-N-Out, for those who don't know, is a local burger chain here in California that thinks
wildly
it's
popular.
As good as Five Guys. Yeah.
I don't know. I can't get into the burger wars with you or into the styrofoam, Joe. I'm just not up on all of that stuff. But let's go to Amarillo, Texas. Brandon watching on YouTube. Brandon, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
How's it going, guys? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Very well. Yeah.
I'm coming into the church right now, and you guys have been a huge part of my conversion from
atheist hedonism.
Oh, I appreciate you so much.
Praise God.
Yeah, definitely. It's a better way. So, like I just said, I'm coming into the church. Here's my problem. I'm a bit scrupulous sometimes. In the recent months that I've been, you know, coming into the church, I've cut out. I was an alcoholic, all gone, blah, blah, blah. One of the things is I'm cohabitating from before I were converted.
Okay.
And so I've gotten almost all the sin out of my life, stopped all fornication, all those things, but we live together, and I really honestly don't have anywhere else to go right now. So my question is, I guess I have this voice in my head, like, if you really trust in Jesus, if you really believe this, you would pack your bags and walk out now to not participate in sin and trust that God will provide for you. But I don't want to be homeless. Where I live is bad weather. I just don't know what to do. I'm trying to work towards, you know, getting out of here as soon as I can and doing the right thing. I just wonder if you had any advice for me or what your opinion is on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Brandon,
thank
you.
That's a fantastic question. First of all, praise God for the incredible moral progress that's going on, the spiritual renewal, even more importantly. That it just seems like he's obviously drawing you and he's giving you tremendous graces to cut these major sins out of your life like alcohol and everything else and fornication. These are not easy things to give up. And so God bless you for it, brother. Actually, out of curiosity, is she kind of on, like your girlfriend, is she on board? If you don't mind me asking.
I'm so happy you asked me that, man, because that's one of the other things that's holding me back is she's sort of a, you know, like Christian in the sense of just, I believe in God. I don't read the Bible. I don't worry about that. And I'm starting to get her to read the Word of God. So that's another reason I don't really want to leave her. I'm trying to lead her into the Catholic Church. And she's becoming open to it. I'm teaching her prayers and all that fun stuff. So that's where she is. Yeah. And I haven't talked to her. I've talked to her about all the other stuff, getting rid of the alcohol, that kind of stuff. And we've done it. But I haven't talked to her about the fact that, I mean, the main thing on my mind is I'm still sinning every day and that I can't keep doing this. I haven't talked to her about that part yet.
Yeah. Yeah, that is that's a really good and very difficult question. That there's a difference. This is where it gets really nuanced, and this is where a priest might be able to give some very good counsel. There's a difference between making the decision to cohabitate with someone that you're not married with, but are like romantically involved with. That is sinful, and you shouldn't do that. That's a different thing from being in a relationship where you're not fornicating, but are still living together, like if you're on a lease together and all that. Those kind of situations can be really nuanced. In those, the immediate solution is to live as brother and sister, meaning don't fornicate. If you find that, you got to watch out for two things. One, you got to watch out for scandal, that people will assume you're living together in a sexual way, and you should make it clear enough, especially to those in your immediate circle, that that's not the case. And two, if you find that you are being led into sin, that it's just too hard to stay chaste while you're in physical proximity, then to avoid sin, it becomes really important then to make the deliberate and kind of decisive move against it. The mere fact that you are living together while dating from a pre-existing arrangement doesn't automatically mean you're committing an ongoing sin. But you should watch out for what the implications of are that, both in the sense of scandal, which could easily lead to, or in the sense of further sexual sin, which could easily lead to. So I don't recommend it, right? But it isn't one of those things where you have to be homeless tomorrow. But you should be looking to rectify the situation by getting married would be one obvious way, by staying with friends if possible, even kind of in a short-term kind of way. I know a parish in Virginia where they actually coordinate with parishioners who have like an extra room, like retirees and the like, to help people in this kind of situation. But it's not if you know, if you're doing separate rooms, separate beds, all that stuff, you don't have to leave tonight. You can figure out like what is an appropriate way to kind of extricate myself from this situation without needing to sleep on the street.
Brandon.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, just thank you so much. That's very, very helpful, man. This has been weighing on my mind. I appreciate it.
Well, it's good. I'm glad that it's weighing on your mind. And frankly, I mean, not in a, like a scrupulous way, but like I'm glad you're thinking about how is this conduct? Because you don't want to just have that be the situation you're permanently in. You don't want to just be like,
right?
You know, here I am, this striving to be Saint Catholic, and here's my live-in girlfriend. That's not
right.
But there is this sense of, okay, how can we kind of resolve this situation? And it doesn't, as again, unless it's leading you into active sin, it doesn't have to be you have to leave tonight. It could be something a little more thoughtful and longer term.
Excellent. Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Brandon, maybe we could send you a copy of Why We're Catholic if you want to, the two of you might discuss that. Or is there another book that we have that you'd like us to send you?
I actually have Why We're Catholic, the audiobook. I just finished it. I've always wanted to read... What was your book, Joel?
I got Pope Peter. I've got Early Church Was the Catholic Church.
Yes, that's the one I'm on.
Okay. The Early Church Was the Catholic Church.
I don't know if that's available, but
yeah. Stand the line. We'll send you a copy. It's not available in audio form right now. There is audio form of Pope Peter coming soon. I just discovered today. Yeah.
Very good. All right. So just so I know, we're sending Brandon a hard copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church.
If he sticks around.
Brandon, hang on the line and we'll do that.
Texas is still considered within the U.S. for shipping purposes, right?
He's still, yes. Yeah, important that you use the word still. For all purposes, not just for shipping purposes. It's like some other ways it's not, but...
Well, ask Texans.
I think the primary question is about the state you're in, not about Texas. 888-318-7884 is the number. Hang on there, Brandon, and we'll get you a book. And we're going to Mark in Chicago listening on Catholic.com. That's our website, Catholic.com. We're glad you're here, Mark. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. Yes, hi, Joe. Question on Mary. There's this guy on social media called Bible Thinker, and he attacks Catholics quite often. I tried to do a little faith defense on my own, and I'm starting with this little problem because what he's saying, he was actually quoting Scott Hahn, which I hardly believe that he's still a Protestant, but he is, and he says that the give an example of Mary as a queen and as a mother of the church, you know, interceding for us is unbiblical, and he's basing, he says, well, what Catholics use is the first king, chapter 2, when Queen Bathsheba intercede on the part of for some guy. Well, we can always look it up. But the subject of the matter is, the fact of the matter is that she not only is not heard of, I mean, initially King does give her credence, says, yes, I'll grant you the request, but we know at the end that he doesn't. He rejects her, and also this kid who was trying to get into marriage with some, you know, woman of his choice has been condemned, and he's sentenced to death. So he says, based on that, obviously, we should not use this example as Mary being a powerful intercession person for us, because even the Queen Mother for the King could be rejected. So I wonder what your take on that is, please.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So for those who may not remember, in 1 Kings, Bathsheba, who is the mother of King Solomon, goes in to speak to him on behalf of Adonijah, who is one of Solomon's brothers. And specifically one of Solomon's half-brothers, not Bathsheba's son. And so when she comes in, Solomon actually gets up, and he treats her really reverently. So in ancient Israel, the queen's kind of like the queen mother, meaning the mother of the king, was the one who was given a special place of honor, because a king, and Solomon's a great example, might have a ton of wives, but he's only got one mom. And so the mother of the king was treated with a special kind of reverence. And so this is very clear when Bathsheba goes in 1 Kings 2, verse 19, she goes to see King Solomon, and the king, we're told, rose to meet her and bowed down to her. Then he sat on his throne and had a seat brought before the king's mother, and she sat on his right. So she's in the right hand of the king. She's enthroned in a place of honor. It doesn't mean she's now trumping the king, like she's more important than him, but no, rather, there's a special honor given to the mother of the king. And I think the Catholic view is like, okay, whatever else happens in 1 Kings 2, clearly this means that from a Jewish perspective, the mother of the king, who in this case is Jesus Christ, is owed honor. I mean, that doesn't rival the king. So imagine if someone came into the throne room and said, hey, you're just a vessel for the king. You're not anybody special. The king would probably strike them down because that's such a disrespectful way to honor dishonor the king by dishonoring his mother. And so this is something I think many Protestants miss, that when you honor Mary, you honor Christ because she's the queen mother. She's the mother of the King of Kings. And that doesn't make her a rival to the king at all. And so that's the basic point that I think any Catholic's trying to make. Some Protestants responding to this, and it sounds like this Bible thinker might be in that category, will say, oh, but look, he doesn't give her what she asks for, which, okay, fine. Because we're told, you know, pray, ask King Solomon, he will not refuse you to give me a wife. And so she goes to Solomon. But here's the catch. I think people just reading this are missing the actual court politics going on. Bathsheba is a very wily kind of figure. She knows her husband is being set up by King David to be killed, and she doesn't say anything about it. And then she has Solomon, who becomes the next king. And so there's this whole kind of complicated story where she looks like she's just losing, but she always comes out on top. And so in this case, Solomon's brother wants to be the king, and she's actually the one in the prior chapter who intercedes to make sure that his royal ambitions are halted. So when she goes in, yes, if you read it at face value, she seems to be interceding for him. What she's actually doing is warning her son of a rival claimant. So she's fulfilling what the brother asked. She's also cueing her son into a rival threat. And so I don't think she comes out of this thwarted. I don't think she comes out of this saying, my son doesn't care what I have to say. I think she comes out of this getting exactly what she wanted. But I think people reading it are missing the kind of intrigue and politics in 1 Kings that are going on here.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate it. It's very helpful. Thank you so much, Joe.
All right. Thank you very much. Got to take a break. Right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Church Pop takes a fresh and fun look at the news shaping our world, featuring engaging, inspiring, and informative Catholic social media content. Find it on Snapchat, Instagram, and on the web at churchpop.com. And you can get Church Pop emailed directly to your inbox. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this Friday. I want to thank again Chris Check for covering for a couple of days. And when I was out, that was Tuesday and Wednesday. And I'm really happy to be back, and I don't want the week to end now, especially with you here, Joe.
Oh, I'm flattered. I forgot it was Friday today and went to lunch and had meat, and then halfway through realized half of my coworkers had gotten meatless because they were just quietly judging them.
Like who, for example, just didn't eat meat sitting right now?
Yeah, exactly. You? Jack, for one.
Jack, and who else on the staff that had no meat?
Like, I don't want to call out the people who successfully observed their Friday meatlessness.
But... And it's not that we're better than you, Joe. I don't want you to feel that way. It's not that we're better than you. It's just that we've done better than you.
Exactly.
All right?
When you're traveling, it's very difficult to know what day it is.
Oh, I know. I only remembered it because somebody told me in line.
Oh, nice.
Somebody's like, well, it's Friday. What are you going to get? I was like, oh, I thought it.
Well, also, you and I had just recorded. So we just did, you'll You'll see this on Memorial Day. We just recorded the Memorial Day episodes. It was right. Monday in my mind, and then went and ate, and halfway through the meal, it's like, oh.
I'm so glad you have trouble with the time traveling, because anytime we do
time traveling is very difficult.
Anytime we do a pre-record, I get confused about what day it is.
Yes, you and I both were doing literal traveling and then time traveling.
And then time traveling.
So I'm giving myself a lot of slack for not being very smart.
I think that that's great to have that kind of compassion on yourself, Joe, when you're in the early stages of the Christian life.
Anyway, let's get to callers.
Joe in Reading, Pennsylvania, watching on YouTube. You are, is Joe there? Yeah, Joe's there. Okay, sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah.
Go ahead with your question.
Okay, this is a quickie. You know the sin of presumption?
Mm-hmm, I do.
Right? Is once saved, always saved, covered in that?
Yes, because if you believe that no matter what you do, you're going to go to heaven, that is the thing that we're warned against. That is not the attitude a Christian ought to have.
And then, but evangelical might, you know, have what is called, invincible ignorance?
I'm not trying to judge evangelicals. I'm just saying, like, for you, Colleen, if you know better, don't fall into that. If it's the question of, is my neighbor sinning? I mean, that's something that God can decide with your neighbor. I can tell you, once saved, always saved isn't true, and here's some Bible verses why. Whether someone is sinning by believing in it is a totally different question. If they're trying to understand and follow the Bible, that's good. They might have misunderstood the Bible.
But they're trying.
But there's a difference between, misunderstanding the instructions and disobeying.
Okay, Joe?
I've been trying to figure that out or find an answer. Finally, I got one, so thank you.
Oh, good. Well, I'm happy to hear you say that.
All right. Very good. Thanks very much for the call. Yeah, people make mistakes all the time. They'll, for example, eat meat on Friday. Joshua in Kentucky watching on YouTube. By the way, Catholics, I should say this. We are not under an obligation to abstain from meat on every Friday. That's a thing.
Not
that
in the U.S.
So it's encouraged, but not required. So I don't want to confuse anybody on that. What we are required to do is some penance on Friday, some remembrance that this is the day that the Lord gave his life for us. So just to be clear.
Yes. That's the exception, of course, is during Lent. During Lent, you're actually required to be meatless.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good practice. We actually had on our website during the Easter season a good encouragement. There's something good in observing the Meatless Fridays, and there's something that's really kind of unifying. I actually really like during Lent when they bring out a bunch of fish at the local restaurants, and it's like, oh, good.
I know. Chris Chek convinced me of this. That there is the personal penance. But there's also the kind of witness of a shared penance that we do together. And
it unifies us. I'm firmly convinced one of the reasons the Jewish people have survived so many difficulties, so much opposition and persecution.
Is God?
Yes, but also keeping kosher. I've met numerous Jews who weren't particularly practicing but still kept kosher. And this created a bond, a sort of solidarity, a shared sacrifice. And I think there's something very good about that.
Yeah.
And that we've often maybe overlooked or undervalued as Catholics.
As modern people, we're probably doing too much penance, though. I mean, there's so many hard penances.
Isn't it so hard to live in 2023 America?
Yeah. Joshua, no.
Yes.
Yes. Joshua in Kentucky, watching on YouTube. You are next. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. For starters, I converted to Catholicism growing up Baptist, making a pit stop in Euphratism before coming to Catholicism.
Welcome home.
You did the tour.
you got all the badges on the way.
I've been Catholic for a few years, but I've been trying to go to adoration since the round Divine Mercy Sunday, at least once a week.
Oh, God
Is
bless
it
you.
Okay if you don't know what to do during adoration?
I'm so glad you asked that. That is, if the answer was no, I don't think I could do adoration. Because what does one do in the presence of the living God? Great question, Joshua. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, so absolutely. It's good. Just to be able to sit there in silence. Pope Francis says, it is good to adore in silence before the most blessed sacrament. To be in the consoling presence of Jesus, and there to draw the apostolic to be instruments of goodness, tenderness, and welcome in the community, the church, and the world. That there's a sense in which you can go to adoration, just bask in the sun, and just receive from Jesus the kind of spiritual recharge to go and do all of those things that you're called to do. The curé of Ars, St. John Vianney, had a story where there was a farmer in his parish who would spend hours a day in adoration. And he asked him, what do you do during all that time? And the farmer was a simple man, and he just said, oh, I look at him and he looks at me. And that's it. That's all that needed to happen. There's a time to just be in the presence of the one you love, and you don't need an agenda. You don't need to have a big conversation. You don't need to have a crisis. You can just go and be there together, and that is good enough, and that is excellent. Like, that is heaven on earth, to just be in the presence and the company of God.
Does that satisfy you, Joshua?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome home, brother.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Craig in Detroit, Michigan, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Craig, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, thank you guys for taking my call. Actually, I want to make a comment before I give you my question. Joe, I just wanted to let you know that in my eyes, other than Cy and those that took the easy road of, you know, not eating meat, you decided to take a more deeper spiritual.
Yes, I definitely took the harder path here. That is a good point.
Yeah, it didn't look like the harder path when he was eating carne asada, but okay, whatever.
Well, I'm sure. actually, my question is a conversation you had with the lady earlier on about the taking Eucharist in the Anglican Church, mm-hmm. and it got me wondering. You said your chaplain used to be an Anglican preacher. Did he have to be, in this case, reordained?
And yeah.
If not, why?
I don't know in his particular case if they did an ordination.
He did.
Or
he was ordained.
Okay. Because in occasion, they will do a conditional ordination. Just to make this fully complicated, there are Anglicans who are former Catholic priests. Like, there are cases, you know, so for instance, Father Cudier had an affair and then he was caught, and so then he became an Anglican the next week. As an Anglican, I'd be offended if I was just like the stopping ground for people who don't care about their promises. But this was like,
wow, Joe is lowering the hammer.
I'm sorry. Like, you look at this journey of like Scott Hahn, it's like, hey, he read all the church fathers, he does all this hard work, he becomes Catholic. You look at this and you're just like, oh, you had an affair, you got caught, and you became Protestant? Like, that's not a point for Protestantism.
Sounds like Henry VIII.
Yeah, good point. What would Henry VIII think of all this sexual immorality in his church? Well, anyway, like all of it, sorry, Anglicans, it's your history. We're not trying to be mean. But all that's to say, you will find these tricky cases where you have someone who may have been validly ordained. But in those, with an exception of those kind of cases, then yes, if someone is an Anglican priest, they're not validly ordained, they will need to receive ordination. I know of one case where conditional ordination was given in case he was validly ordained, but it doesn't seem to be necessary to do the conditional because there was good reason to believe he wasn't.
Okay, Craig?
There is a branch of Anglicanism that has valid ordination?
No, it's not a branch. It's that you'll occasionally have former Anglicans. And there was a movement in the early 20th century to try to do co-ordinations with Orthodox bishops to try to restore apostolic succession because there were enough Anglicans who were worried that they'd broken apostolic succession. So there are some maybe more confusing or complicated individual cases where you might have to say, well, is there validity here? But we know that the form Anglicans use for ordination is invalid.
Craig, thanks very much. Great question. So I imagine there must, well, I don't know if must, but perhaps there are cases where a Catholic bishop became Anglican.
Yeah, in the beginning, certainly there are a lot.
Yes, I'm right. Oh, that's a good point, Joe. As a matter of fact, that's why St. John Campion's a saint, I think.
St. Edmund Campion, but yeah.
Yeah, Edmund Campion, sorry.
And St. John Fisher, you just combine him into one super saint.
That's exactly what I did.
Yeah. St. Edmund Fisher, St. John Campion.
Something. All right, Joe, clearly I had a bad week, and you're taking advantage of me here at the end of my
life. Red meat I'm eating on Friday.
Yeah, right. It's my soul and my reputation. That's what's your...
It's a little sparse, but there's enough there.
Man, There's no way I'm going to win, so I'm just going to say goodbye. Goodbye, Joe Heschmeyer.
Goodbye, Si. I really enjoyed being with you.
I'm sure you did. And we'll see you next time. God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.